Humanity is in trouble. Some of us are here to help. Together, we will take the next step.
Hello and welcome back to the Next Step Podcast. I'm your host, Jarrett Sanchez, and I have somewhat of a simple episode for you today. I'm just going to speak here for just a couple minutes and set up a clip I'm going to be playing. Well, not much of a clip. It's actually a talk, a recorded talk given by self-described Wisconsin liberal Gar Alperovitz, which he gave to the E.F. Schumacher Society, I believe, in March of 2010. And I think what he has to say is extremely relevant today, especially in light of the things that are going on in Wisconsin with the teachers' unions. And, you know, I certainly have some opinions on that whole situation. But they are very much half-formed opinions. And I'm going to kind of get to this idea in a minute of my half-formed opinions and its relation to not doing the Next Step podcast as frequently as I would like to. Before I get to that idea, I want to say that recently I did post some things on Facebook where other people, some of which are guests, former guests on the show, read it and see it and respond to it. And basically my opinion is that all the protests and things going on in Wisconsin are great. You know, I mean, it needs to be done. I heard of even one action taken by some fire department where they withdrew all of their money from a bank that helped, that either housed Walker's money or helped fund his campaign in some way or something. I forgot the exact story, but, you know, the bank took a really big hit simply because they had any business to do with Governor Walker. And, you know, that's great. I love that kind of stuff. That's, you know, the people taking action and, you know, it's exciting and it's saying, hey, you know, we're not slaves. You know, we have rights and we're going to do these things. You know, we're going to take action against injustices. And I definitely agree that things like that should be done. But here's where my disagreement with what happened and what is happening in Wisconsin rests. And it's that simple things like protests and boycotting and stuff like that shouldn't be our only tactics. It should be further down the ladder. And especially with all of the revolutionary uprisings happening in the Middle East and in North Africa, all that kind of helps create the sense that, oh yeah, we just got to fight the power. We have to just amass ourselves in the streets and, you know, we have to really just take the system head on. And I disagree. I think that is one of the last tactics we should employ. And it says a lot about, perhaps about the strategy of divide and conquer, that we're not first coming together as citizens in groups first and deciding courses of action and using collective power in a face-to-face setting to affect change. And that's a very nebulous concept, pretty much, what I just laid out. And I don't have, again, very well-formed thoughts on how this can actually be done. But I do have the notion that a lot of the things I've covered on this show, like Tom Attlee's work, Jim Ruff, Juanita Brown, all these social process activists, I think that has a big part to do with what I consider a better strategy for the middle and lower classes to organize and to influence the government's actions. I mean, that's what we're supposed to be doing here in a representative democracy. We're supposed to be electing people that represent our wills. But that's not exactly happening. And you got people like Governor Walker who are overstepping their bounds and playing political tricks. I mean, these people should not have jobs, not in the public sector. They should be flipping burgers, you know, or teaching English or something like that, which teaching English, I don't equate with flipping burgers. What I mean to say is that, well, I would like to see Governor Walker flipping burgers, but, you know, that's probably less reasonable. He must have some intelligence as he's a governor, so maybe he could teach English instead. The fact that these people make it into office and get away with the things they do, and this is on the state level, look at the national, federal level. The fact that these people are in office and get away with this stuff is despicable, and it should never get this far. And the only reason it does, in my opinion, to bring it down to the very essence of why this still continues, is that we're not well organized enough. We're not cohesive as a nation, as a very large nation with a large population as well. Not nearly one of the largest, but I mean, over 300 million people spread out across a vast country. It's a big task to really get people organized. And I don't think there's any way to do it in such a way that we have a uniform statement of what the people want. There was a talk by E.F. Schumacher himself, Decentralizing Economics, which you will actually hear in a future episode of this podcast, probably in one of the Sunday sermons. And he tries to make the distinction, well, he does make the distinction, between unity and uniformity. And so when we talk about how can we organize the people, I think a lot of people are actually thinking about uniformity. And we're all thinking along the same lines and doing the same things. Whereas unity, you have individuals coming together and creating a sort of new intelligent collective. And again, this what I'm rambling on about gets back to my opinions on the Wisconsin struggle and why we should be working more with our social processes and gathering our collective understandings first and using that as leverage against politicians. You know, when you have people working at the precinct level, I mean, if you even know what a precinct is, if you're an American citizen, do you realize you are a member of a political precinct? You know, you start working at that level, forming groups, you know, study groups for like an hour or something, like you're going to hear Garl Perovitz talk about. Just forming community ties, addressing big issues, coming up with collective statements, unanimous statements, and using that as social feedback for conversation. So now we have a town or even a county that has formed consensus councils and citizen initiative reviews and all of these other things that are being pointed to by people like Tom Attlee and Juanita Brown and Jim Ruff and others. You know, we start forming these, and then statements of the people's will at these smaller localities of county and neighborhood and congressional district, these statements are being formed. And then you have something that is very powerful. You have a voice of the people on paper, on file, in the minds and the hearts of the people who take place in the actual councils, and then the people who are around the town who know about the results of these councils and are talking about this. And this is all then presented to politicians, and they cannot avoid it. They can't say, oh, well, we don't know what our people want, our constituencies, or we think we know what they want, and this is what we're going to do based on what we think they want. And if they're doing something different than what the people, the constituents actually want, you know, that's something to be made very obvious and blatant and saying, well, no, we hired you to do this. Now you will do this, or at least we will work together. Now, if you have a different idea based upon your information, Mr. Representative or Mr. Senator, well, we can talk. We can talk about that. You know, maybe you do have some information that we need that we don't already have. Well, again, if they don't listen to us after all of this, after all of our organization and all of our community will and community intelligence gathering and collective understanding, they're still not willing to listen to us, then we protest, then we organize, mass demonstrate, you know, clog up City Hall, do all of the things that need to be done. When they don't want to listen to us in a civil manner, when we've gone through the process of organizing our collective understanding and developed a statement of the will of the people. You know, and again, we're talking about uniformity versus unity here, so it's not going to be like an exactly streamlined thing. You know, there's going to be a lot of different ideas going around, and there's going to be a lot of big conversations happening, but that needs to happen more and more. We don't have big conversations enough in our society, in our communities, in our day-to-day lives. We talk about the same old bullshit, and I've covered this idea with Frank Aragona in a past episode. You know, it's very hard to engage in very important conversations in public. People either are just too uneducated about the subject and just rattle off a bunch of opinions and then don't listen to other people's, or they just don't want to touch this stuff. They don't want to get political. They don't want to blah, blah, blah. They just want to talk about sports and the weather together. You know, again, we need to develop a civilization. No, not a civilization, I'm sorry. We need to develop a society that is more engaged in open dialogue on the important matters at hand that face us. You know, government doesn't run itself. Civil society doesn't run itself. The world you know, can exist just fine without us. So we can live in a way that is going to harm ourselves and the world, or we can live in a way that is going to benefit both. You know, and we're not really doing that right now. There's a lot of great stuff that's happening, a lot of good work, but, you know, it's almost like the evil is really getting the upper hand in a lot of ways. So it, to me, it's a bit of a scary situation when I see the only tactic being used, well, the greatest, most publicly known tactic being used against chicanery in the political arena is, you know, protests and demonstration, people trying to form human chains around City Hall or something like that. I mean, that should be down the road. That should be after, you know, a more organized approach has been tried. So again, these opinions of mine are half formed, and I can understand where a lot of people might be very upset with what I'm saying and thinking, well, you're undercutting the value of these protests, and this is the potential beginning of a real movement of the people and a revolution that we need, and this, that, and the other thing. And you know, it's hard for me to really know. But my intuition has gotten me this far to at least learn about these social process activist workers that are out there, and they're the ones that are saying, hey, we need to organize our intelligence first. Yes, it's great to fight the man, and it's necessary, but we're just a bunch of, you know, it's a crowd herd thing. It's a herd mentality thing. It's more uniformity, just gathering in the streets and then going home, and you don't remember the people that were out there. You don't have any stronger community ties just because we all demonstrated and held signs and yelled and bullhorned and got pepper sprayed by the police, you know? We're not a better community, a more well-organized and cohesive unit in society. No, that's uniformity more, in my opinion. We need unity first, and we have to come together in ways that are new, because obviously what is going to work hasn't been done yet, because we still have all of these struggles. So we need new tactics. And I think it starts at the precinct level first, on up. And we have to gather a collective intelligence and start to form cohesive, coherent statements of the people's will that are then used as a basis for dialogue and for further conversation and understanding between the people and also the people and the politicians. So that's the end of my little rant. Now, I'm just going to read a little bit to you here, and this has everything to do with why I haven't been putting out so many Next Step episodes. I've been interesting myself much more in education in the past year and a half or so, and how can people without a lot of money become educated? And I found that, as lame as it might sound, going back to the old liberal arts method of education and seeing what value is in it for modern people is one sure way that even poor people can obtain a semblance of an education and at least the development of their intellectual capacities. So the liberal arts, I think, are vastly understood and mostly understood in the context of, you know, perhaps the Catholic Church or just medieval times and used by elite schools and things like that. There's a lot to the liberal arts, and depending on who you ask, you're going to get a different answer about what the liberal arts education really is all about. And from my understanding, not everything contained in the whole of liberal arts is useful to modern people, to poor people, to people who need to organize and become more intelligent. But there is a lot there for people who are poor or near poor and who are also looking to develop their mind and become better citizens and more well-organized. There is so much there. For instance, the liberal art of rhetoric, if properly understood and used by the citizenry, is a tool of critical thinking and critical examination. So all political statements made by politicians will then be analyzed by people with the practice and skill of rhetoric under their belt. And these people can say not just, oh, I disagree with you, it just doesn't seem right, it doesn't feel right, what you're saying, what you're doing is wrong. These people are going to give specific examples, and this is going to be something that is commonplace. Anybody could learn rhetoric. It just takes good teachers. It takes good self-teachers, autodidacts, and it takes time and energy. Can't play video games all day if you want to get an education. And so I've been doing that more or less in my free time, which is very sparse, in the past year and a half, developing my understanding of how liberal arts education works and what can be useful for people in modern times, and then also applying myself to the method. And it's been a very slow-going process. But one of the first things that I realize is that the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. And also, seeking definitions is a very important part of liberal understanding. So, again, I'm trying not to talk so much on the show because I don't always know exactly what I'm talking about. I'll go back and listen to something I've recorded and I say, well, what did you actually mean by that? I'm trying to say something. I have something to say, but it's still more in the intuitional part of my being, of my consciousness. I'm not able to fully develop my thoughts yet because a lot of key terms that are thrown around, I just don't exactly understand. So it's very difficult when you don't have many people around you who are well-educated and well-spoken and well-read, and you're trying to do this all on your own, and then I'm going to sit here and put out a podcast of just a bunch of my opinions all the time, and then I'm going to completely probably disagree with those opinions 6 months or a year down the line. You know, that's kind of difficult for me. And so, again, there's a lot of topics that I want to cover on the show, but I can't do it yet because I don't have the full understanding to really get at these ideas that I'm searching for and that are calling me and attracting me. There are these things that I'm working on, these bigger ideas, just because I have my unique perspective, and it's not easy to elaborate with such a poor education and a not well-constructed mind. So, there's going to be, most of the interviews I think I'm probably going to end up doing this year, for the rest of the year, will have more to do with, not politics, but things like permaculture, community building. There's some good things going on in a nearby community by me. And I think there's going to be some good results in the form of podcast episodes to come of all that stuff. So, I'm really not going to cover too much the political stuff, but for right now, it's what's on my mind, it's what's in the air, and I think it's also necessary. As much as you want to bliss out on permaculture, it's necessary to be a good citizen. So, what I'm going to read is from The Great Books of Western Civilization. The Great Books of Western Civilization, put out by Encyclopedia Britannica, is somewhat of the baby of one Mortimer Adler, who is the name bearer of the Mortimer J. Adler Planetarium here in Chicago. Never understood why Mortimer J. Adler, somebody who I'd never heard of, was named a planetarium. And I realize now, because astronomy is considered one of the higher of the seven liberal arts, and Mortimer Adler was a big proponent of the liberal arts education. I don't necessarily agree with everything he believed, but I find a great teacher in the form of the writings of Mortimer Adler. His greatest contribution to this set called the Great Books of Western Civilization is the Syntopicon. Now, the Great Books of Western Civilization were judged as great books based upon a certain criteria, mostly which being how many great ideas they contained. And the group working here at Encyclopedia Britannica came up with, I believe it was 102 of the great ideas that have faced mankind throughout the history of the West and have been dealt with in the collected writings of the West. It does include some of the East, like the Tao Te Ching, the writings of Confucius. But mostly these books are all from the Western civilization, people like Homer, Plato, on up to Goethe and Descartes and things like that, Karl Marx. And so the criteria for what makes a great book in this set is mostly how many of the great ideas it contains. And now something I've been using as a tool of education is the Syntopicon found within the great books. The Syntopicon takes these 102 great ideas, which are found throughout all of the books in the Western, the great books of the Western civilization set. Takes these ideas, and there is an essay for each idea, basically giving an outline and an introduction to the idea, and also with a lot of links to the great books that cover this idea, which sections of those books cover the idea, and it's just a really useful tool to begin understanding these things. Some of the topics are love, angel, death, war and peace, and one of the great ideas that I need to know more about, and I will ask the audience to send me any information, any books, any things that I should know about related to the great idea of citizen. And it is from chapter 11 of the Syntopicon of the Great Books of Western Civilization that I'm going to read a bit from. And that is chapter 11, Citizen. I think with a better understanding of at least some of the bedrock of thought contained in Western civilization on these ideas is a good starting point for an education. It's not an end in itself. It's a means of understanding. You know, it's not to be able to just repeat what Locke had to say about it and what Aristotle had to say about it or Karl Marx. It's to be able to see the great conversation that has been going on through the great works of Western civilization, since most of the people listening to the show come from the West, though not all. I think it's just a good foundation to have, you know. So when we're going to talk about, well, what are the duties of a citizen, something I'm very interested in, we'll have some ideas that are well-formed and based upon, you know, understandings from the past. I hope I'm not rambling too much. I hope this is making sense to you and I'm not, like, losing the audience. The talk by Garal Perovitz that you're going to hear in a few minutes is really great, so please just bear with me. I know it's been about 20 minutes now that I've been rambling on, but I ask just for a little bit more patience, and hopefully this is enlightening for you. So I'm just going to, you know, give an idea of some of the stuff contained here in the Syntopicon, some interesting thoughts on the idea of citizen. And I want to encourage and invite as much feedback on this and every other episode, mostly through email, thenextsteppodcast@gmail.com. You can find me on Facebook if you want. Let me know you're a fan of the show if you're going to add me on there, so I know you're not some stranger. I don't know. It's Facebook is something I do in small periods of free time that I have that are otherwise not useful for deep study or anything like that, you know. Cleaning the house, coming to see if somebody left me a message, posting a link, things like that, you know. Getting ready for work, got 5 minutes to kill, hey, let me read a story somebody else posted, things like that. So, otherwise, I really appreciate emails mostly, personal emails. So, thenextsteppodcast@gmail.com. And here is some selected readings from Chapter 11, Citizen, from the Syntopicon of the Great Books of Western Civilization, edited by Mortimer J. Adler. Okay, citizen, like comrade, has been and still is a revolutionary word. Both words have been titles proudly adopted by men to mark their liberation from the yoke of despotism or tyranny. Both titles are still sought by those who have not yet gained admission to the fraternity of the free and equal. The rank and status of citizenship first appeared in the ancient world with the beginning of constitutional government in the city-states of Greece. The Greeks were conscious of this fact and proud of it. In terms of it, they set themselves apart from the barbarians who were subject of the great king of Persia or the Egyptian pharaoh. The Spartan heralds, according to Herodotus, thus addressed the Persian commander, "Thou hast experience of half the matter, but the other half is beyond thy knowledge. A slave's life thou understandest, but never having tasted liberty, thou canst not tell whether it is sweet or no. Ah, hadst thou known what freedom is, thou wouldest have bidden us fight for it, not with the spear only, but with the battle axe." Not only Herodotus but Thucydides and Thucydides, but also the great tragic poets, notably Aeschylus and the Persians, record this Hellenic sense of distinction from the surrounding peoples who still lived in childlike submission to absolute rule. But the Greeks were also conscious that their political maturity as self-governing citizens was, as Aristotle intimates in the Politics, a recent development from the primitive condition in which tribal chieftains ruled despotically. The basic distinction between subjection and citizenship is inseparable from the equally basic distinction between absolute and limited, or between despotic and constitutional government. The difference between these two modes of government is treated in the chapter on Constitution. It is sufficient here to note that the difference in the authority and power possessed by rulers, according as it is absolute or limited, corresponds with a difference in the status, the degree of freedom, and the rights and privileges of the people ruled. Later in the essay, we have a few paragraphs here. Unlike citizens, the subjects of a king, especially of one claiming absolute power, have no voice in their own government, and no legal means for protecting their natural rights as men. Or women. I think men is used in the sense of all human beings in all of these works. So long as the absolute ruler does not tyrannize, he governs for the welfare of his people. And so, though a despot in the sense of wielding absolute power over political inferiors, he is benevolent in the sense of serving rather than using them. But if he ceases to be benevolent and turns tyrannical, his subjects have no recourse except rebellion. They must resort to violence in order to emancipate themselves from a condition which amounts to slavery. A citizen, on the other hand, is safeguarded in his legal as well as in his natural rights and, in some modern republics at least, he is provided with juridical means for rectifying supposed injustices. For citizens, the right of rebellion is the last, not the only, resort. And later in the essay, we encounter the subject of the idea of citizen in relation to education, which I think is highly relevant. The problem of education for citizenship is in some respects stated in almost identical terms by such different political philosophers as Plato and John Stuart Mill. In both The Republic and The Laws, Plato emphasizes that education is the constraining and directing of youth towards that right reason which the law affirms. By this, he means not only that education will affect the laws, but also that the laws themselves have an educational task to perform. The educational program is thus planned and conducted by the state. The guardians, the only citizens in the Republic in the full sense of the term, are trained for public life, first by the discipline of their passions, and second by the cultivation of their minds. Their passions are disciplined by music and gymnastics, their minds cultivated by the liberal arts and dialectic. It's a bit of a confusing sentence, as dialectic is one of the liberal arts, but nevertheless. In the democracy which Mill contemplates as an ideal, the most important point of excellence is to promote the virtue and intelligence of the people themselves. He does not outline a specific curriculum for the training of citizens, but it is clear that he thinks their education cannot be accomplished in the schools alone. The superiority of democracy, according to Mill, lies in the fact that it calls upon the citizen, quote, to weigh interests not his own, to be guided, in case of conflicting claims, by another rule than his private partialities, to apply at every turn principles and maxims which have for their reason of existence the common good, and he usually finds associated with him in the same work minds more familiarized than his own with these ideas and operations, whose study it will be to supply reasons to his understanding and stimulation to his feeling for the general interest. In this school of public spirit, a man becomes a citizen by doing the work of a citizen and so learning to act like one. If the future citizen is to act like a free man, must he not also be trained in youth to think like one? Vocational training prepares a man to be an artisan, not a citizen. Only liberal education is adequate to the task of creating the free and critical intelligence required for citizenship. Hence, in a state which rests on universal suffrage, the educational problem becomes greatly enlarged in scope, if not an intrinsic difficulty. So, with those thoughts and ideas in mind, I leave you alone with self-described Wisconsin liberal Gar Alperovitz. Many blessings, and I'll catch you guys later.
Thank you, Don. My mother would have appreciated that very much. I had a wonderful dinner here this evening with the members of the board of the Land Trust, so, and I asked them what I should talk about. What I meant was, I'm not interested in giving a lecture. Okay, so anybody who came for a lecture, now's the time to escape. What I'm interested in, and I ask you to participate in this discussion in this way, is not to listen to what I have to say as new information, some guy came and gave a talk, but is there anything in it that the person in your seat might do about any of the things we talk about? So that's what we used to call in the 60s a heavy rap. The question is existential. Did you come to listen, or did you come to what can I do with the conversation? Okay? So that's the context. Secondly, there's a lot of practical things that we've been doing in the Democracy Collaborative and that we can talk about. I'm going to give you a web page, so we're going to come back to it. It's www.community-wealth.org. Be sure to put the dash in, because there's another website without the dash. And you will find in this a great deal of detail on various kinds of things that community groups now do to change, basically to change structure and ownership of wealth. So, for instance, the most obvious one in this group would be a land trust. and you'll find a whole section on latest information on land trusts, what's going, state-of-the-art research, who's doing what. Hopefully we cover the ground. But you'll also find information on some 11,000 worker-owned companies in the United States. 11,000. There are more people now involved in one or another form of worker ownership in the United States than there are members of unions in the private sector. The American press doesn't cover that, but it is very conventional, very common. Now, they come in different flavors. Some of them are very good, some are not so good, but they are out there as a conventional changing, let me use a phrase, it's a conventional changing of the ownership of the means of production in the United States that's going on all over the country. You'll find co-op information. You'll find information on nonprofits in general, but also nonprofits that are involved in community service, sometimes called social enterprises. And there are a range of those. There's 4,000 or 5,000 neighborhood corporations. There are lots of municipal corporations where the city is trying to go into enterprise in order to solve either environmental problems or land problems and make profits for the city. There's a lot going on the ground. So that website will give you a feel for it. There's some of it discussed in my book as well. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but I wanted to give you that as a background. Third, we're doing a big project in Cleveland that's gotten a lot of press lately. And there's an article in the last week's Nation that I wrote with some colleagues, Time Magazine, The Economist, Business Week. Several magazines have covered it recently. And it's a very interesting project involving land trusts, worker ownership, et cetera, et cetera. And if I don't talk about it, which I may not, somebody please, if you're interested, ask me a question about that. And I want two other questions that I want to put on the map so that when we get back to them, if you're interested, we come back to them. I'd love us to get to this place, but it usually best at the end, is does a capitalist system have to grow in a way that destroys the environment? And if so, what do we do about that? So we come back. What we're doing is seeding the audience with ideas. We're seeding the environment with things that I don't want to forget, okay? And finally, the question that Don raised, which is regionalism. Genuinely, what do you do about a continental-scale system if you want a democracy, okay? So anybody, please remind me if you're interested that if we don't get to those things. Now, the place I'd like to start this discussion is with an experience I had during the anti-war movement of the 1960s, and a young organizer took me door to door during the anti-war period, and he said, I'm going to teach you something about politics, and you're going to learn from me. And I was, you know, a professor, and he was just a really young kid, activist kid, and I'm going to show you something. And what he did was he walked me door to door in the city, not of Cambridge, but in one of the industrial suburbs of Cambridge, I think it was in Somerville, as I recall, height of the war when the entire Congress, except for three people, were for the war. The president was for the war. The major news enterprises were for the war. The television was for the war. The period before Martin Luther King made the courageous step to oppose the war, which it took him a long time to do because it hurt the civil rights movement. We went door to door, and you start knocking on the doors. And people would say, well, you know, I'm against the war, but nobody else on this block is. I'm against the war, but nobody else on this block is. And what we'd go door to door, not everybody, but a large number of people actually agreed that the war needed to be ended but didn't know how to act. So if you think the system needs to be changed, possibly your neighbors may have those feelings too, but they don't quite know what to do with it. And in fact, the question most people ask most of the time, what they're really interested in, is not really what should we do in the sense of all the models that are available. There are plenty of models available of the good society. The question people really are interested in, and I'm interested in, and I suspect some of you are, is there any way to conceive of changing something like a political economic system of the most powerful system in the history of the world? That's the real question most people actually are asking and worried about, and it's kind of right below the surface. It isn't for many people, and I suspect the kind of folks who come to a meeting like this, I suspect many people here would like to see major change of one kind or another. But the issue is deeper. It's not about politics. It's about social change. So let me address that, and we'll come back to, I have a lot of thoughts which I'd love to share with you about what do you do about designing the next system. There will be a next system. History is not over yet. How do we think of it in new terms? And I'm going to back off and give you a way to think about it that I'm developing for myself. And it's a new book, and it's also a way I've tried to come to terms with some of the oddities of this particular advanced corporate capitalist system. And the way to think about it for me is this. Many of the European countries have had the capacity to mobilize what is often called a social democratic solution to the problem of corporate capitalism. Now, what does that mean? In this country, we call it liberalism. That means that the core institution of the economy is the large for-profit corporation. And everybody knows it has an uneven path, its growth, its environmental implications, its equity implications are very severe. And the role of politics is to mobilize different groups to keep it in check, to clean up the environment, to change the distribution of income, to provide welfare programs, etc. That's the model. It's not a socialist model. It's not, very interestingly, but those are who, it's not even a free enterprise competitive capitalist model. I've been reading a lot of conservative economists, genuine conservative economists, for whom I have great respect and disagree with. The Chicago founders of the Chicago School of Economics, Milton Friedman's teachers, understood that what we now have was nothing like what they were talking about. They thought the giant corporation was destroying capitalism because it organized power and then organized it politically, and the real free competitive market was of individual entrepreneurs and large and small medium-sized firms was thrown aside, and with it went freedom and liberty and democracy. I'm talking about conservative economists. H.C. Simon, the founder of Chicago School and the revered teacher of Milton Friedman. So what you now are looking at in these systems are large corporate structures, and in all of the European and in our own system, attempts to hold them in line somehow. In this country, we're finding failing attempts, as the weak attempts. I want to set it up that way because it's an important way to begin to think about where we might be politically and historically, and why I think that way of thinking about it opens a possible path forward. And here's one way to look at it. You really need to begin to think about how different our capitalism and our social democracy really is from most other countries. I'm not going to give you a lot of figures, but here's a couple. The United States now, and this is a measure, it's a good measure, I sometimes use the word outcome trend, it's a good measure of how powerful our progressive politics is in the traditional modality, that is to say, holding the corporation and managing it. The United States ranks 117 in inequality amongst all of the world's economies. It is next to Turkmenistan and Ghana in inequality. Now, that's a disastrous way of thinking. It's a horrible thing. But it also tells you how weak we are in our capacities to manage this system historically. 1% of American wealth owners in the United States today, 1%, own just under 50% of all productive assets. That's a medieval design. And I mean that not rhetorically. 1% having half of the productive assets in the country, that's your society. 5% have 70% of the productive assets. And with those numbers comes extraordinary power. Another way to look at it is the United States federal government is about 22% of the GDP. If you add in the states, you get up to 30 or 32%. In most other European countries, the range is at 28 to 30 at the low end, up to 45, a measure of how weak our politics in the traditional mode to manage the problems of a large corporate capitalist society. There are many, many ways of looking at it. We don't have, many countries have free college education, as their politics has generated that. Many countries have free daycare. Many countries give family leave paid. Many countries, I could go on, you know the story. So we are almost last in virtually every one of those lists. The importance of that and why it's a good starting point is that, I'm going to offend some people. I come out of liberalism. I worked for House and Senate staff. I was a staff director in both the House and Senate, working for liberal congressmen and senators. Senator Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day, I was his legislative director. I come out of liberalism. That's my background. Wisconsin liberalism. Excuse me?
Let's hear it for the liberals.
Yes, well, that's where I come from. And I come out of Wisconsin liberalism, which is a really progressive version of liberalism. That's my background. Our goal was and is, and at that time, and I still affirm this goal, was to organize political power to constrain the corporate system. We never asked whether the system ought to be changed. Or could you achieve any changes in major trends that way? Let me be harsh, Ed, but over the last 30 years, there has been no change in income for the bottom 80% wages for the bottom 80% of workers. Zero. Corporate incomes are going way up. So the question was, does that form of politics actually work in this particular capitalism, given the history of this particular capitalism? And the outcome trends in most areas of the environment, not all, but most areas of the environment, the outcome trends are either negative or stand put. In most areas of income distribution, it either gets worse or is stable, and there's no evidence that we've achieved anything. A few years ago, we passed legislation, much-hailed legislation, and I was for it, and I still am, to increase the minimum wage. Probably people here were for that legislation. Yes. Okay, that's a liberal achievement. I come out of liberalism. I'm with that. There probably other people here, maybe one or two people out of liberalism. I told you, it's a heavy rap, okay? The achievement of raising the minimum wage brought it back not quite to where it was when John F. Kennedy was president. The minimum wage in real terms has gone down, and what we were able to do is prevent it from going much further down. We are... If you think of what I'm talking about is in system terms, liberalism is a resistance movement, not a progressive movement that can advance its values. It is resisting negative trends in the distribution of income. It is resisting negative trends in the environment. It is resisting negative trends in terms of democratic capacities. We are by far the least liberal nation in terms of imprisonment. We are seven times as many per capita lose their liberty and are imprisoned in this country than any other society. We are very close to China in that regard. What that politics that I have come out of in most is that we attempt to slow down this process. Thank God, I'm for that. But if we're interested in changing the trends, there will have to be much more radical change. It's obvious. And a lot of people aren't interested in changing the trends, or they think that more fundamental change is not possible. Both are reasonable positions, that it may not be possible to do more than be a resistance movement. Fair enough. I'm not so sure. I'm a historian. And what one knows about from history is that societies in great decay, in great pain, in great alienation, have a way sometimes, not inevitably, but sometimes, of beginning to throw up answers that are new answers because of the pain, because of the decay, because of the problems that are growing. Another way to say that is, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. used to write about 30-year cycles when he thought the pendulum would always swing. I suspect there are a lot of folks in this audience who hope the pendulum will swing. That's a formulation and theory of politics. It's a crude theory, but it's what most progressives actually have in the back of their mind. Maybe we'll elect somebody new in the trend. People don't talk about the trends because the trends are too hard to face, but maybe something will get better. And it's useful. I'm suggesting to you that in this particular corporate capitalist system, the pendulum is not likely to swing, but deeper processes of change may well be building up that are of great importance, and that we need to pay attention to them if you stand back from history and look forward thinking about where does this go over the next three decades. All right, let me switch back and give you a different way to think about it. I mentioned to somebody at dinner tonight, and you'll find this in my book as well, that my heroes in the United States are the civil rights workers in the 1930s and 40s. It's very easy to join a movement when there's a movement moving. It's very hard to lay the foundations for the next transformation. Partly because it's very hard to do, and also because who knows? There may not be anything. You may be just whistling in the dark. And in particular, the people in Mississippi could easily be hung, and many of them were, from a tree by trying to do something. So people who have the courage in the time of potential prehistory to think that they, I'm talking to the person in your seat, to think that they might, we might possibly be in a period of establishing the potential foundations for a transformation, rather than the pendulum might swing and we can slow down the decay. Those are the people who interest me a lot in history. Those are the people who bring me to talk to, you know, folks like you guys, because I suspect some of you are in that place. I think that we are actually entering the most interesting period of American history that I have ever experienced. I think it's far more interesting than the 60s. And the reason is the 60s raised issues of civil liberty, civil rights, environment, and then they came right up against the economic power and stopped dead in that Martin Luther King movement when it got to the poverty issues was dead in the water before he was assassinated because the power of the game was in the economic sphere. And I think Americans are beginning to enter a period where the economic issues cannot be ducked, and secondly, the environmental issues cannot be ducked. That's a large order challenge that when it is confronted, nobody wants to confront that. But when you are forced, per force of economic and social pain, to say, something's really wrong. Not, gosh, if we elect the next guy, it'll be all fine. No, there's something deeper that is wrong. I think that we are in an era where that idea is being driven up against millions and millions and millions and millions of America. And that is the precondition of saying, by God, something different is going to have to happen. Not the inevitable precondition. Societies decay. Rome decayed. Societies turn to violence. Fascism can happen. But societies also can build and renew and have revolutions. We had one, the American Revolution, Shays' Rebellion, right around the corner. Things also are possible. So I am a very cautious historical optimist, prudent optimist, and I'm interested in what the prehistorical possibilities of the next great change might be. That's our time in history. Yours and mine. If you follow what I've suggested, it's a potent time, potentially, of great importance. So here's where I start with it, and what I've been doing, and some of the things that I've been thinking about, and let me give you some sense of why I am modestly optimistic. I see people at the local level struggling with problems that they used to think if you elected the right guy, it could be solved for them, might happen. And they now know. Bob Swan, one of my great heroes, knew this early, what Susan knows. They now know that you can't leave it to them. That doesn't mean you shouldn't elect. Politics is important. I'm not saying. But unless there is genuine change at the local level, it ain't going to happen. Now, we know that as a theory. But what I'm saying is that what we're seeing in the work that we've been doing at the Democracy Collaborative is vast numbers of people actually doing that. Now, the press is dying anyway, but the press doesn't have the money to cover it, and they don't cover it, they don't want to, they don't think it's an interesting story. But when you see after city after city after city where poverty and pain at the local level is going on, people being forced to try new things usually forms that change the ownership of wealth in mini form, like a land trust or a co-op or a worker-owned firm or municipal ownership or all the things I was talking about, that's coming. It's hard to do. Land trust is not easy to do. Tough thing. And when Bob really was talking about it 30, 40 years ago, nobody was talking about it. Getting that down and actually doing it is the preliminary question you need to solve. By the way, over the last 5 to 6, land trusts have been on the margin of society for a long time. People would not take them seriously. Chicago now has a massive land trust. Washington's got a massive land trust. Irvine, California, is building 10,000 units in land trust. They're exploding all over because you can't solve the problem without changing the ownership pattern. Interesting. Interesting that an idea on the margin, per force of events, is forced into the mainstream as now becoming conventional. The same thing's happening, by the way, for city ownership of different... We're doing this in Cleveland, but you probably know about capturing methane, turning it into electricity, socializing that, municipalizing it, providing jobs, etc. That's happening all over the country because of the crisis, financial crisis and the environmental crisis. An idea that was way on the margins now becomes, well, we need to do that because you can't solve the problem another way. That sort of process is happening in worker ownership, cooperatives, land trusts, social enterprise. We follow this stuff, so we see a lot of it. And my view is that it's happening because the traditional way of solving problems and the way many European countries can still do, but we are an exception, we have a much weaker social democratic capacity, that I think is going to be a really big deal in this country because it's already expanding and exploding. And you people, many people here in this room, are part of that. So, and I think those of you involved with Schumacher Society or Schumacher's ideas, that idea took a long time to get to the place where anybody took it seriously. I think you're going to see a real explosion based on the fact that there are lots and lots of models out there and the pain is growing. At quite a different level. So that's in roughly good times in America. That's the period from the 1960s to now. As the pain level deepens, and it will deepen, we can go into that at great length, why that's happening, why the public system does not have the power to allocate resources through taxing and spending. The power is deadlocked, and they're going to cut more and more. And why the stagnation is built into the economic system now. Those of you who are not economists, let me give you the simple version. If workers' wages don't increase, and don't increase, profits increase, who's going to buy the stuff? That's a recipe, technically, for stagnation. And it doesn't mean that you collapse. It means that you stagnate. You get a little bumps. And we're entering that period, clearly. And if you can't tax more because the people resist, and you can't spend money, problems build up. And that period is also we're entering as well. I think that is a hopeful scenario. Let me tell you why. Because I think if it were to collapse, I don't think it would go to the left. And if it is, the term I use, if you have an environment historically of stalemate and decay, but not collapse, it is a time for learning, growing, and building, and learning enough to actually generate the preliminary ideas, practices, and people for a much larger possibility. If it collapsed, you wouldn't have time to learn and develop, and I think we do. I said I thought this is the most interesting period of American history I've ever lived through. It may be the most interesting period of American history, period. I say that because the elements that are developing point in a direction that is well beyond capitalism. It's also well beyond traditional socialism. The model that's beginning to emerge, and we can talk about this, I'll talk briefly about what's happening at the national level. The model is changing who owns capital, not the 1% or the 5%, democratizing it, attempting to democratize it in a way that respects the environmental constraints. Most and many of these institutions I've mentioned have that built in rather than having to come after the fact and regulate. It is a model that is highly decentralized and changes ownership, because if you don't change ownership, you can't change the political power structure. Let me say that again, fellow liberals. Liberalism thought you could do in the United States what is possible in many European countries, change the relationships and the outcomes without changing the ownership power relationships. That was the idea. And that's the idea that's challenged, I think, by history now, and it's the idea that's challenged also by the new models. They are different. That's happening at one level, and I think as we move into a period of stalemate and decay, you're going to see a lot more of that building on the wealth of experience that is out there. You want to build a worker-owned firm? I can tell you who to call. 35 years ago, you want to build a land trust? Not many people to call. You want to build a worker-owned company? Not many people to call. You want to do really interesting co-ops? Agriculture maybe, but not urban. Not today, and it is a great historic achievement. There are experts and people all over the country who can tell you actually how to do it. They know how. That's something that we can build on. So that has been developing, and I think will develop intensely as the pain level increases. And it is also cultural. There is an idea growing about how to do these things. I sometimes say to my friends working in the Cleveland Project, I'm not interested in co-ops. I'm interested in the idea that they offer us ultimately for politics. Say that again. Of course I'm interested in co-ops. But the notion that there is a way to think differently about the principles of the next system is more important, ultimately, politically, and particularly for younger people. It's like the old Bob Swan's original. You didn't think about the principle of a land trust, and now it's a broad principle. How does that happen historically? Now, let me take that back. How do people like us make that happen in the prehistory of the next era of great change? I don't want you to get off the hook. We're on the hook, all of us. We can't avoid the hook. So I think that's happening, and I think it's very important because it's generating principles. At the national level, I think there are several other processes already happening also because of the weakness of this particular form of capitalism and its social democratic possibilities. So one of them you see right before your eyes, the healthcare system. I mean, every other advanced nation long ago has had a universal healthcare system. Everybody knows that. But the problem, and whether or not it goes through in the Obama form, it's dicey. It is obvious to anybody who takes a longer look at the trends that that system will be socialized over the next 20 years. The financial pressures are so great, the divisions amongst the corporations that are benefiting from it, the insurance companies, the pharmaceuticals, the hospital companies, each one has different interests and they're being divided and conquered. But most important, the American corporations are against this system, the large corporations, because it's too costly in international competition. So that system is going to be forced into Medicare for everybody over time, in my judgment, and we can go into that in great detail. I think you're talking about that path is all but inevitable. It's a very different process. It's a process generated by the failings of that particular sector. Now, it's important because it's 20% of the GDP, a fifth of the economy under a very different structure. So that is another big piece. What's interesting about what's happening in finance and banking is, again, because you do not have the capacity to manage them in the old way, you can't regulate those guys. You can in theory, no problem. You can in theory regulate them in terms of their banks not having individual positions where they can risk. You can regulate them and make them have more capital. You can do all sorts of things. They're too big to fail. All of that is possible. But in fact, in practice, you do not have the power to do that. So what you're going to have, I mean, most financial experts are very clear on this. You're going to have another crisis. And maybe you'll be able to break them up. That's the favored remedy now. The too big to fail, break them up, make them littler. And what we know about that is that once they get littler, the big fish eat the little fish, and they're right back at the same trough. That banking system ultimately is going to be a candidate for either collapse and crisis or some form of public ownership. And again, I swing that over a 20-year cycle. The dynamics are very different from the capacities of many European countries to manage those systems. Now, if you listen to what I'm saying, I'm suggesting to you that the oddities, this is sometimes called American exceptionalism, the oddities and weakness of our system, but it's strong enough not to collapse, put it in a very different cycle from, well, if we all organize, we can get the corporations to do it, or maybe the pendulum will swing. I call the cycle a reconstructive pattern. There is the possibility of institutional redevelopment at the local level, institutional development of a very different kind at the healthcare sector, institutional development in terms of banking. I think we're going to see transportation shift in the auto companies. Two of them are nationalized. Now, that's very primitive stuff, very badly designed nationalization. But some parts of those systems, when we go to mass transit and rail and high-speed rail, nobody in this country makes that stuff. So who's going to make it? You're going to buy it from the French, you're going to buy it from the Japanese, or ultimately could shift some of that production to companies. Could be worker-owned companies. Could be worker-owned nationalized companies. What do you mean? Well, General Motors, Chrysler are worker-owned nationalized companies in very primitive form. But that model, I suspect, will see a lot of experimentation, particularly in sectors where there's heavy taxpayer money and the demand for jobs and buy local and all taxpayer cash. As the pain level increases, I think those are going to be pragmatic models that can be built upon. And we could go on, but what I'm going to suggest to you is this weird and paradoxical idea. And if you even peek into this slightly positively, rather than say that's way off the charts, the beginning points of a very different design are evident in different parts of the society, coming out of a fairly successful period of history, moving into a period of great decay where what is really going to be demanded is new design principles out of the pain. The old stuff don't work. We need a solution. The new stuff is in development. It is, in my view, a staggeringly interesting period of prehistory. Maybe not. Societies do decay. Violence does occur. Rome did decline. Fascism does happen. But also, maybe not. Maybe not. Real good evidence. There's a lot of vested interest. Check this out. We have a vested interest, all of us, in believing nothing can be done. Don't have to do anything if you believe nothing can be done. Don't have to struggle with these very nasty problems if nothing can be done. So I always say, check that. Maybe so, maybe not. My own view is that it is clear that many of the things that people are already doing are important in their own right. They offer positive things to do. You are doing them in this area. The next stage, this is where you've got to rise up a little bit, the possibility that you are laying groundwork in the prehistory for a possible transformation, that takes a little bit more. It takes something like the American feminist movement did in the 1960s. You know, feminism was a ridiculous idea. Challenging the most powerful cultural institutions and relationships in the society? Are you kidding? Most people in that period, my mother couldn't work. It would be something that would be bad for the family. Not only about raising kids, but that would be a bad signal that my father couldn't properly support her. My mother was an intelligent woman who could have been a lawyer, a doctor, whatever, but the culture did not allow that in the 40s and 50s. That was broken in half out of people doing something in transformative ways. Civil rights movement did it. The early environmental development did it. The anti-war movement did it. One of the things I suspect many people in this room know, and younger people don't know. Younger people don't know what a movement is when it begins moving. They don't have that experience. Some of the gray hairs in this room know what it is when people actually begin to react both practically and morally and reinforce each other to create real change. Then you have something that's very different from elect that guy politics. Then you have real dynamism. Now, I may sound like I'm a utopian. I'm a very hard-headed Paul. And I'm a hard-headed historian and a hard-headed economist. I think the possibilities of that kind of thing growing out of the emerging conditions that are quite specific in this country are quite real. And that to discount them is to miss, or I wouldn't even say miss, it is to delay the possible development of these changes. Let me give it to you in a different way. The most interesting thing that's happening politically in this country, politically, if you read it carefully as a historian, is the Tea Party stuff. Now, what they are, the Tea Party movement. Now, the Tea Party movement has got a lot of crackpots. It's got a lot of right-wing nonsense, in my opinion. It's got a lot of free enterprise talk. It's got a lot of anti-government talk. But at its core, what those people are saying, I'm from Racine, Wisconsin. Those are my people. I mean, folks that I grew up with and went to high school with. What they're saying is there is something really rotten about the government cutting deals with the big corporation and taxing me for something that doesn't work. That happens to be true. The progressives ought to be saying that. That happens to be true. And they ought to be damn angry, and they are. Where are we? The problem is they want to go back to an archaic idea, and they're being manipulated by the right, and they're being propagandized. And the only way forward, this is nasty stuff, if you can't go back to free enterprise capitalism, and you can't use the old liberalism that I certainly came out of, you are going to have to talk about changing the system. You're going to have to talk about changing who owns the system. And if you're interested in democracy and the environment, you're going to have to talk about it in a way that is practical, damn practical, expanding, democratic, and real. So, my modern heroes are people who are actually thinking about laying the groundwork for the next big change. Those are my heroes. Any and all of you can play that game. The resistance is not in the political system yet. The resistance is in us. This is not about why don't those guys do something. It's about why don't we do something. Yeah. Well, now, so here's the test. I'm going to give you a test. You shouldn't have invited me. Here's the test. Can you spend 1 hour a week doing anything about this? 1 hour. Will you study? Will you call a group together? Will you say, what can we do here that takes us another edge down the line? Can we learn about something? The test is 1 hour a week. Very hard test. Nobody wants to do that. They want to talk about that. So that's the test. And person in your seat, I'm giving you a test. And you can look in the mirror tomorrow morning and say, I don't know. But that's it. And I'll give you actually a practical way to proceed. I got a lot of heroes, but another group of heroes is the early women's movement. And what the early women's movement knew was something else. Chairman Mao said that power grows out of the barrel of a gun. And the women's movement said, no. 6 women get together for coffee once a week, study, figure out something practical, and reinforce each other. That's where power comes from. And they were right. So, probably people in this room have 6 friends. You could get together you could read, you could learn about what's the most advanced things being done, you could study a little history in terms of what other societies have gone through. Then you could say, what could we do that moves the ball a little further than what we've tried here? Pushes the envelope just a little further. Talks about it. And by the way, you're going to be called socialists. But you're being called socialists anyway, so that doesn't really matter anymore. If you talk about changing these things, that's really one of the most interesting developments, that anything in the liberal spectrum is now called socialism. So you might as well play with worker ownerships and co-ops and land trusts and, public ownership of this and that, socialized medicine. You're going to get tired with that brush. And then say, show me a better way to do it if you've got an idea and that it'll work. I mean, the language, the rhetoric's all gone. Forget it. So that's my test to you. Now let me come back because I remembered what I was going to tell you about Cleveland. Cleveland's really interesting. And I also remember I was going to tell you about growth, and then you can sit me down and forget about it. We went out to Cleveland 3 years ago. And we know all about, one of the things we know about is a lot of stuff going on in the country, and the web page is interesting. And we had tried to do at the national level, bringing people together from these various areas that shared the principle of changing ownership practically. Land trusts and, you know, co-ops and worker-owned companies. And we had a big meeting, and we had it out at the Aspen Institute. And we all, the national leaders are there. And we thought, if they got together, they'd see they kind of have similar ideas. And, of course, that was so naive. They all went home and did their thing. They were all in their silos, right? They did good things. I'm not knocking what they did. But the notion that they could bring something together did not occur. So then we did, by chance, it was Cleveland for odd reasons, just could have been any city. And we said, well, let's see what happens locally, because people are doing all this stuff locally, too. We'll bring them together. Maybe there's this, they'll see something in common and something will happen. So we had a day and a half meeting, leadership of these various groups. Also, importantly, and I didn't mention this, but we could get into what states are doing. State public pension funds are investing in interesting things. States are owning investment in new technologies as ownership, not just not owning as ownership, changing the relationship. So we had some of those people there from the state investment side. And what we did was just display. We brought in some people doing interesting things from different parts of the country. Did you know you can do X? Oh, they're doing it over here. And did you know you can do Y? And just knowledge is really important. People simply did not know what is actually being done and can be done. You want to do it? Here's his telephone number. That's just how they do it. He'll come in and talk to you about how to do it. So knowledge turned out to be very important in that community, and I think in any community, because there's so much practical knowledge out there that gives people heart and inspiration about what can be done. A complicated process followed that. But what is going on now in Cleveland, great leadership group, picked up on the notion that this is not just about green jobs. This is about green ownership. So what's happened there is, some of you may have read about this, there is a large co-op built on the Mondragon model and designed for geographic impact. Everybody know about the Mondragon model? Yes? No. Mondragon model, okay. Very interesting. It's like land trusts here. 50 years ago, a little bit over 50 years ago, Catholic priest in the Basque country of Spain. Now, you guys live in America. The Basque country of Spain is where Franco shot down a lot of people and hung the rest. Really nasty politics. Coming out of that during the Civil War, how do we get jobs for our young people? And this priest and then some younger people began setting up what was a particular form of co-op. And it is a production co-op, but it is designed in ways so that if you set up a new co-op, it's part of the same system, and they don't break away. And there's a central bank, a central fund. So there are 110 integrated co-ops, high tech, very successful financially, some of them green, some of them not. Service industries, manufacturing industry, advanced research, very, very successful businesses employing over 100,000 people in this form. Y'all love this. The current ratio of CEO to worker, average worker in the United States is between 200 to 300 to 1. In 90% of the Mondragon is the name of the region and town, 90% of them, the ratio between top and bottom of highly successful, very successful, not, this is not your corner co-op, it's highly successful, very high tech, 4 to 1. In the other 8%, it's 9 to 1. That's the max. So that's a really interesting model. Read about it. That's what you're studying, by the way, in your study group. Pick it up because it's really interesting to look at. So the model in Cleveland is based in part on the Mondragon design. So they're not one co-op, but an integrated group of co-ops in one geographic area, trying to build up a culture and structure. The first firm is a industrial-scale green laundry. It's the most, it's the greenest laundry maybe in Ohio, but certainly in the northern part of Ohio. And it's operational now for the last 6 months. The second one is a solar installation company, co-op, worker-owned. The third one, which will open in about 2 months, is a greenhouse, a 10-acre greenhouse in Cleveland, Ohio, cold weather like you've got here, with a capacity to produce 5,000 heads of lettuce a day. These are not minor things. The next one, there's a newspaper being developed. They're going into manufacturing, all around this same model, but in the poorest part of Cleveland. Average income is 18,000 in this part of Cleveland. And the model is interesting in that respect. It's also interesting to me in a very different respect. So you can do things if you want to, is the point. And you want, this is much tougher area than you live in. It's really poor black area with very difficult situation. And the model's building, and there's a lot of interest, and probably a lot of other cities will pick up on it and so forth. What's really interesting about it, so now we get to design principles. It is not simply floating in the capitalist market. I use that phrase for a reason. Because if it were, and if it is, right now it's fine. It is competitive. This is not being subsidized. But it is also directing its market at big hospitals in that area and universities. Sometimes we call them the anchor institutions. And that's important. They're willing to buy from them because they want the environment around them to be better and because it's goodwill and because there's a little political pressure on them, so forth. But the model is particularly interesting in a different respect. Energy, which is one of the other sectors, and health are expanding sectors. They're not declining sectors. So the growth path of this form, by design, is likely to expand on its own. You're not in a situation where it's a declining area and people are killing you to get in. More interesting for the long haul is that the model is likely to be open to political discussion. It is important, like it is to give contracts to women, to minorities, to small business, it is important to give contracts with public money. Health and energy all are dominated by public money, to companies that change the wealth pattern and anchor jobs in the community. So it has a political thrust to it that has qualitative reasons. Anchoring, by the way, worker-owned companies have another advantage. It's not just about changing and democratizing ownership. They don't get up and run away. People live in the community. And that's really important when we have, as a society, allow the corporations to come and go and throw away communities. Literally, we throw away cities. You build up housing, you build up roads, you build up sewers, you build up schools, et cetera, and hospitals. Companies go and all that goes down, and you got to build it again. It's ridiculous. Worker-owned companies are particularly interesting in this respect because they anchor and save the capital and save the environment. So there's an edge to the model. There's a real edge to the model because what I've just designed for you in terms of principles, I didn't design it, but if you think about it, that is a highly decentralized, cooperatively based, very democratic, community-sustaining, environment-enhancing, wait for the punchline, community-sustaining, environment-enhancing model linked to a planning system with public impact. In this case, the planning system is a healthcare system with public dollars and energy. That model is different from most models. It is a decentralized model, radically decentralized, but also linked to a planning system. Now, it isn't called a planning system. It's called the healthcare sector. But it has it in it when we build our mass transits and our rails and our high-speed rails with public money, that planning system is going to have to purchase from somebody. That public planning system, that design is different from corporate capitalism with liberals trying to push it in the right direction but don't have the power to do it. That's a different model, highly decentralized. All right, I'm just about done, and I remembered the last ones, and I'm going to sit down and let you guys talk. You can drop Germany into Oregon and Washington together. I sometimes tell my students, those dinky little European countries, you can drop most of them into Oklahoma, which is true. This is a continental system. It is very hard to manage. We're at 300 million. We'll be at 450 million in about 35 years. You tell me how to have participatory democracy in a continental system of 450 million people. You solve that problem, you get the Nobel Prize. It's not possible. Can you do it? So ultimately, for a variety of reasons, And I think we're seeing some of that now, that the system is just too large for any democratic control. Ultimately, if most of the states are really too small to manage as political economies, and the continent's too big, the thing intermediate is called a region. So I suspect what we're going to see in this process is, as Washington is stalemated and as some of the states try to take action, a lot of this will move to the regional level. New England has experimented already in the environmental area. California is a region, and when it goes through its crisis and comes out the other end, you may see California getting really interesting when that thing tips over and goes the other direction, because that is a region. So my own view is, if you're looking for design principles, in the period of prehistory, going forward at these various levels of what you can do locally, what may happen because of the national crisis in healthcare, finance, et cetera, are really interesting. But decentralizing to the regional level, I suspect, is where it all comes out. Now, one last thing. Of course, none of this may ever happen. This all may be pie in the sky. But the interesting thing is, virtually anything you do locally on this subject, or in terms of politics, or in terms of pushing the progressive side of what might be done in a state like Massachusetts or Connecticut, all of which are within your grasp, all of that, if it doesn't transform the principles and become the prehistory, all of it is really useful to do anyway. So, thanks for having me. Sorry to bother you with all these problems, but look in the mirror tomorrow for 1 hour.
You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner, because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on the rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Arm, woman liberationist, and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.